The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
So I think the first piece is to understand the context for change. What does a normal day at FBI headquarters look like? And then thinking about how you add in change, right? The first piece I think that's important to understand for context is the normal course of business at FBI headquarters is the pace is just extraordinarily high. Just on the criminal side, you're talking about tens of thousands of cases, right, that are open and operational any every given day. And headquarters on the criminal side, for example, are just making sure the field offices have what they need, responding to any legal process requests, trying to do program management, right? So there's kind of a core business tempo that's extremely high.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, August 13th, 2019. Sasha O'Connell is executive in residence in the School of Public Affairs at American University and the director of the Terrorism and Homeland Security Policy Master's Program there. But more importantly, for our purposes, she had a long career at the FBI where she served in a variety of strategic management positions. She was basically the FBI's chief strategy officer. She joined me the other day in the Jungle Studio to talk about what it takes to turn a ship like the FBI, what it takes on issues like IT and technology, what it takes on issues of investigative focus, like changing an organization to focus on terrorism and then noticing that you have to also focus on cybersecurity. And we talked about how to make an organization like the FBI think about recruiting diversity. It's a wide-ranging conversation with a super interesting person. Hope you'll enjoy it. And it's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 443, Sasha O'Connell on Turning a Ship Like the FBI. I want to start just with who you are, because the title Chief Strategy Officer of the FBI is not something that a lot of our listeners will have any familiarity with. So tell us a little bit about your career and where you came from and what it means to be the FBI's Chief Strategy Officer.
Sure. Appreciate it. I am definitely a little bit of an odd duck when it comes to certainly senior executives in federal law enforcement. I'm non-sworn, non-agent, but grew up at the FBI. My background is in academically public administration. So what I've studied and worked on my whole life is how government works and works effectively, and specifically done that in the context of the FBI for about 15 years. I joined the FBI through what's now called the Presidential Management Fellowship Program, was then called PMI, and had just incredible opportunities to grow up in the counterterrorism program. But always my sort of responsibility area was around strategy, performance management, strategic communications, and all those other things folks might not necessarily think about when they think about a career at the FBI.
So you haven't kicked down any doors?
I've been around when folks have kicked down doors, which is awesome. Sort of a huge side benefit of the job. Got to do some sort of quote-unquote ride-along opportunities, worked in a lot of command posts, but absolutely my gun-carrying, non-kind of operational roles all the way along.
You served for a long time, and they were incredibly fateful years at the Bureau. I mean, probably the years in which the Bureau saw the most dramatic change ever. for the institution. So tell us about the period that you were there and the directors under whom you served.
Sure. So it's really an honor and privilege to serve under three different directors. So I joined the Bureau in 1998. And I worked for Director Free. I was in what was then not even a full division. There wasn't a counterterrorism division per se, but I was in the component working CTD. Incredible time right after the East Africa bombings. And I worked in the counterterrorism program through the spring of 2002. So I had the opportunity to be in the Boston office on 9/11 and have that experience. I actually left the Bureau for a little bit of time, a couple of years, and came back in 2007. As you mentioned, I did have the opportunity to work in what was the FBI's first kind of, we would call, enterprise-wide strategy office. So under Director Mueller, they created a new senior executive role. There's always been the director and the deputy director. And the FBI created what's now called the associate deputy director, really a chief operating officer of the organization. And off of that office, they started to build a staff. So when I came back in 2007, I got to help staff that and start working strategy. Incredibly interesting time for a number of operational reasons, and a really interesting time because Director Mueller was focused in a way previous directors weren't on kind of really explicit and formal strategy implementation. He brought the balanced scorecard to the FBI, and getting an opportunity to ultimately lead that office that led balanced scorecard implementation, development and implementation was a huge opportunity. I then did a number of things in working some cyber issues and helping. I ran the executive staff in the criminal division. And then under Director Comey, he stood up. It was actually an idea under Director Mueller, and Director Comey stood up the FBI's first Office of National Policy. So the FBI has always had a congressional affairs office, a public affairs office, and actually a law enforcement, state and local law enforcement engagement office. But Director Comey started two new offices, which was very big change for the FBI. One focused on private sector outreach and one focused on National Security Council coordination. And I had, again, honor, privilege, timing was right. I was asked to stand up and lead that NSC-facing office that coordinated policy implementation with the National Security Council. So a lot of change, both organizationally and substantively and operationally. And yes, very lucky to be there under three directors and get to be a teeny part of huge change at the FBI, all positive in my mind.
All right. So, you know, I don't want to focus on personalities here, but when you're talking about strategy, institutional strategy, particularly at an organization as vertically integrated as the FBI, the personalities and interests of the individuals at the top actually matter a great deal. How would you describe Louis Free, Bob Mueller, and Jim Comey? They're three radically different people. How would you describe their strategic objectives as similar to and different from one another?
Yeah. I think in terms of mission, strategic objectives, culture, and leadership, they're more similar than they are different, right? All extraordinarily mission-focused, all extraordinarily, you know, appreciative of the people of that organization and what they give. So in a lot of ways, similar. When it comes to formal strategy implementation that I was involved in, very different, I would say. Working for Director Free, things were more bottom up. So we were in the counterterrorism program at the time, and the planning we were doing was more bottom up, organic, which has a lot of benefits. It was also a different time, right? This was.
And when you say bottom up, mm-hmm. I assume you mean sort of like field office driven. Things are investigations develop and strategy kind of develops out of response to incidents. Is that fair?
Let me back up and say, when you think about strategy at the FBI, people tend to think about investigations and casework. That's actually kind of the bread and butter of what the FBI does really, really well. And so, yes, there's a lot of program. We would call that kind of programmatic oversight of those and making sure resources are allocated the correct way and that the correct threats are being focused on. When I think about strategy at the FBI, I actually think about everything else. How do we develop a workforce for the future, right? How do we have the best IT systems implementation? Those are actually the things that are harder at large organizations and harder at the FBI.
Well, and the IT infrastructure development was a
classic challenge.
Was a saga that went mm-hmm. on for more than a decade at
Absolutely.
The Bureau.
Things like, you know, bringing in the kind of cyber computer science expertise we need, right? Thinking about diversity in the workforce, thinking about IT implementation, thinking about how do you work cyber in an organization where cyber cuts across the traditional program areas, right? So when I say bottom up, on that second kind of strategy, I really am talking about at the division level at FBI headquarters, right? So now assistant director led. And this again, back, if you go back to 1998, this is before the Government Performance and Results Act had just been passed. This is before performance.gov, right? Everyone didn't have red, yellow, green in government back in the day. So under Director Free, it was more at the division level that the assistant directors and the section chiefs were working together to say, okay, let's take a step back from those investigative needs and say, where do we want the program to be in 5 and 10 years? How do we develop a plan to get there? What resources will we need? How do we leverage the whole organization to drive this program globally? So to your question, under Director Free, that was more bottom up. And again, that meaning kind of at the division level at FBI headquarters working on those things. Director Mueller had a very different kind of from the center top down. And again, there's pluses and minuses to each of these. And I don't mean to put them in sort of distinct boxes because there's some crossover, but certainly they are on different ends of this extreme.
And do you have a sense, I mean, my impression of Director Mueller's centralizing qualities, which, you know, for listeners who don't know, you know, Bob Mueller is kind of a sainted figure in a lot of public debate now, but this was loathed by a lot of people in a lot of field offices at the time. And he was regarded, I mean, always with a lot of respect, but this was not a popular feature of his directorship. Is that fair?
It was certainly a big change for the organizations, right? You mentioned the field offices, right? Our 56 field offices around the United States and legats around the world. You know, on a day-to-day basis, the folks who lead those offices have the responsibility and authority to make a lot of decisions, right, and move a lot of things forward. You have things, when things start to get centralized, either on the national security side operationally, in terms of cases and more oversight, or what I would call strategy, kind of the back end of the house, the COO stuff. Sure, there's kind of a culture like, wait, what, right? We're kind of out. Things have tend to be deferred. And it's not all or nothing with any director, but there certainly was a swing that direction with Director Mueller, I think with a lot of benefits. But certainly culturally, it was a large change.
No one's proposing to go back, right? I mean, when I think about it, like, you know, I didn't mean to sound critical of it when I said people objected to it. I don't detect anybody arguing for a new revised sort of federalist decentralization of the Bureau.
Well, I would say it's interesting, like where you stand is where you sit, right? If you work out in a field office in Anchorage, Alaska, you might feel like, you know, a little less centralization might be great, right? There is always, and again, from my public administration standpoint, the FBI or otherwise, there's always a balance to be struck, right, around central oversight, coordination of resources, ensuring priorities, right? That's where all that strategy comes from. But then ensuring out in a field office, and we have formal mechanisms, the FBI rather has formal mechanisms to do this, you're crosswalking those national strategies with local needs, right? Who were, you know, because your stakeholders in Anchorage are very different than your stakeholders in New York City, your stakeholders both in terms of your partner organizations and your community needs. So in the organization, it's always that balance between what needs to be centralized, brought to center, managed to be most both efficient, and efficiency is not the only value, right? But efficiency and equity and strategically versus letting folks out in the field, you know, meet those needs of those local communities, which can be very different across the country and across the world for our legates.
And is it fair to say, like, how much of the Mueller centralization instinct or initiative was a function of his personality and organizational temperament, and how much of it was a function of the fact that he shows up on, you know, September 2nd or something, and a week later 9/11 happens, and you have to, you know, he gets this direction from the president, don't ever let this happen again. The FBI is suddenly the domestic lead on all the not just investigative dimensions of 9/11 itself, but also the preventative dimensions of any subsequent attack that somebody might be dreaming of. And so it's a response to circumstance. It always seemed to me that there was sort of like an element of both to it, that this is both personality as conditioned by circumstance. Is that fair?
I think it's fair. It's hard to know what's in someone's mind. I think it's fair. Those two things, I would add a third factor, in which is kind of out in the world, there's also a movement in government for performance management. Again, Government Performance and Results Act had been passed. You're just now, we take some of these things for granted now, but before 1998, you know, very few departments and agencies had strategic plans at all. Nobody had red, yellow, green performance.gov type websites and dashboards. So there was an underlying movement in government as well. This idea of, you know, running government more like a business, what does that mean? Having data-driven decisions, all of those things were kind of academically coming on board. Congress was getting interested in those things. And so I think that was a third kind of influence that was happening just at the same time. It's hard to say, you know, which was more important than the other. I think the personality piece is there. I certainly think the threat environment and political environment piece was there. And I also think there was this kind of good government, new resources and drive toward planning and performance metrics and all those other things.
How does one understand Jim Comey's period as director with reference to his two predecessors? Mm-hmm. On the one hand, it is cut short. On the other hand, it's tonally extremely different, mm-hmm. at a strategic level, but also at a, you know, sort of a human leadership level. How does he fit into this picture?
Yeah, again, I think the three leaders, the three directors are actually more similar, having worked with them all, than they are different. But in this way, I would say that Director Comey was a balance somewhere between in the sort of top-down versus bottom-up centralization views. My experience, working with Director Comey is somewhere in the middle there in terms of there were pieces that, you know, organizationally were focused to the middle and were centralized, and he wanted to keep them that way. And there were some new pieces he put in that bucket. And there were other places where I would say it was more like working with the director Free in terms of he was a little bit more comfortable with things being decentralized. Now, to your point, why is that? Is that personality? Is it threat environment and political environment? You know, it's hard to separate out. But I would experience him as kind of a blend between the other two in that regard.
All right. So I want to talk about, you know, in your and just to be clear, the reason I have not asked you about Director Ray is only that you did not serve.
Did not serve under Director Ray.
Right. When did you leave?
I left in December of 2016.
So I want to talk about, there seems to me, two very seismic strategic shifts that take place in the Bureau in your period there. One is the 9/11 shift to terrorism, and the other is the less discussed shift that takes place starting under Director Mueller but accelerating under Director Comey toward the cyber domain. And you played a substantial role in both of those. But I want to start with a sort of gestalt question about this, which is, turning a ship like the FBI is a massive undertaking, particularly given the degree of autonomy that some of the field offices experience, as well as the fact that in some ways the FBI is directed by a lot of U.S. attorneys' offices rather than its own hierarchy in significant respects. So let's talk about the generic problem. Let's say you're cruising along and then all of a sudden the president of the United States says, all right, from now on, we're focusing on space aliens, right?
Like, yeah, the space alien strategic shift. Right. I'm with you, tracking.
Like, how do you do it?
How do we
it?
Begin to do that? Yeah.
How do you start?
Yeah, it's such a great question. So I think the first piece is to understand the context for change, right? Sort of, what does a normal day at FBI headquarters look like? And then thinking about how you add in change, right? So the first piece I think that's important to understand for context is the normal course of business at FBI headquarters is the pace is just extraordinarily high, right? You mentioned that cases just on the criminal side, you're talking about tens of thousands of cases, right, that are open and operational every given day. And headquarters on the criminal side, for example, are just making sure the field offices have what they need, responding to any legal process requests, trying to do program management, right? So there's kind of a core business tempo that's extremely high, right? And I just mentioned criminal, but obviously there's the whole national security side of the house. There's all kinds of programmatic operational things the FBI does every day. And that tempo is extraordinarily high. So you got to sort of think of that to start. Layered on top of that is a process that we talked about a little bit, was really amped up under Director Mueller and formalized. But there's a formal process around budget and resource allocation and program management that is very robust, right? Making sure that, you know, all the money that comes in to the FBI from the Hill is spent wisely, that we're keeping the big picture in mind, that folks are, you know, the intel piece is matching the threat piece, is matching the operational piece. And there's a whole band of work happening around that. There's a whole compliance piece happening all the time. There's a huge piece around stakeholder engagement all the time. And we're talking about a normal day when we haven't had a catastrophic act or something that is unfortunately so frequent. So with that setting in mind, then you think about a change in direction, right? You mentioned it could come top down from the White House. It could come bottom up from our field offices. It could come kind of from the center in terms of, I gave the example of driving for more diversity in the workforce, right? It could come organically for that. And the question is—
Or it could come like cyber from all directions
at
once,
one time,
right?
Absolutely.
The president says it's repeated presidents say it's a priority, but you also have a very sustained wave of attacks
incidents
that you're responding to from the bottom up.
Yep.
It's kind of multi-directional in its orientation.
Yeah. So if you have one of those, right, you have that either a surrogate event that drives change, right, something specifically has happened, or as you said, some kind of other organic change. How do you do it? And in my experience, there's kind of two buckets that need to get underway. First is, as Mark Giuliano, the deputy director I work for, is wonderful, would say, you need a mom or dad, right? There's a people aspect to it. Leadership, extremely important, I think, in all organizations, certainly at the FBI. And having a leader with the responsibility, the authority, you know, the ability to drive change is extremely important. So there's the people piece, and you really do need a mom or dad to kind of drive that change. Then on the other side, and this is paid, I'm very passionate about, you need that kind of institutional system, right? It's not enough to have a mom or dad who leads meetings and we talk about things and people go off. What the Bureau's really gotten much better at for change that requires work across the branches, and the FBI is organized at headquarters into branches, the big changes often require, we can talk through cyber, you know, things in counterterrorism, change across the organization. Those are the hard pieces. You get that overarching mom or dad, but then there are now systems in place. Pieces from the balance scorecard are still there that institutionalize the strategy development, the strategy articulation, the development of timelines and action plans, accountable executives. And those mechanics, that stuff I love because I'm a nerd, I'm a strategy nerd, are so critically important. You can't do that. You can have the best kind of strategic planning process in place without a mom or dad. It's not going anywhere, right? The strategic planning weenies like me can't lead that. So you need that mom or dad, but you also need those institutional processes that get all the pieces and parts across the different branches collaborating around an issue. When those two pieces are in place, we see incredible success making very challenging change. But again, taking a step back, I mentioned the whole complexity on a good day. Now you're trying to overlay this. You know, then you add a critical incident that happens, right? It's very challenging to keep eyes on target on long-term strategic change because there's so much pulling off. But I really do think the FBI, in my experience, has come a long way, both in understanding and growing leaders who can take that mom or dad spot and building those systems that support them and ensure the organization, even if that mom or dad is, for example, pulled off to work in a command post, right, or some of the folks necessary to move things are in a command post for a month or 2 months, that these pieces can keep moving. Because sustaining that energy, even if the director says or the president says they want something, right, in a bureaucracy, sustaining that energy around change over time is very challenging.
All right. So let's try to bring that down to the level of case study.
Okay.
And I want to talk
about— What do we do all day? Yep.
I want to talk about two cases of that, one, both of which we've mentioned. I'll leave the terrorism stuff aside because I think our listeners have some familiarity with the what it took for Director Mueller to turn the ship on that, and it's fairly well studied. The cyber shift is much less well studied, and the FBI's diversity and workforce work over the last 10 years has been largely unremarked upon at all. So I want to focus on those two. All right, it's the mid-2000s. Everybody knows that cybersecurity is a problem. The United States is getting hammered with attacks. And, you know, we have to reorient the FBI to be first rate in that department. What happened?
What happened? Sure. So a couple things. First of all, there's kind of near-term tactical things that can always be done, right? At a field office level, the SACs have the authority to move folks around to a certain extent.
Wait, before we get to that, though, yeah. I want to go back to the IT infrastructure issue, because the baseline that we were operating against here was catastrophically bad. When I left the Washington Post, I don't remember when the last time I had to write an editorial about the virtual case file, the latest IG report about how another $1 billion had been thrown down the toilet trying to create virtual case files for working FBI agents. Like, how late was the FBI, how bad in the technical sphere? So, like, just to set up the conversation that we're about to have.
Yeah, I mean, I can't speak specifically. So all of that is run out of what's called the IT branch, right? ITB for us at the FBI. And that was never where I worked. I certainly was a customer of theirs and experienced some of these change things. Certainly was not ideal. When I joined the Bureau, I had a pager. I had no email at my desk, right? I mean, you know, government in general and FBI in particular is not renowned as an organization for having that kind of infrastructure that's cutting edge. And there are a lot of reasons for that, again, as a student of public administration, that go beyond the FBI, right,
but
as a government.
Did that coexist with forensic excellence capability? Mm-hmm. I mean, so you had these situations where people could do amazing forensic work on computers but didn't have email addresses?
So I can say in my experience, and again, I've been out, I guess, 2.5 years now, sort of my personal experience at the FBI, and I will say it's been my experience in other organizations outside the FBI is – you know, there is amazing, whether it's forensic work or work happening down in the operational technology division, that is absolutely mind-boggling, right, and cutting edge. And meanwhile, we are struggling and have had struggles delivering kind of core IT capabilities for the workforce. I don't think that's super unusual in organizations to have pockets that are doing things that are off the charts and, you know, whether it's around HR or marketing or IT, but have trouble doing those things for their own, you know, broader population. Definitely that is the case at the FBI, that pockets of excellence.
You can trace subjects' emails with a high degree of capacity, but you're the guy at the desk next to you. It's in 1998, still doesn't have email.
I mean, that's a dramatization of the situation. But yes, like we could be struggling with some core IT things at our desk and then getting briefed on something happening in the operational technology division that blows your mind, right? 100%.
Okay.
That had that experience, 100%. But back to your question, great question about strategic change, whether it's IT, whether it's the big change, we didn't sort of articulate it specifically around building up the intelligence workforce, right, after 9/11 and that professionalization of the intel workforce at the FBI, whether it's cyber. Again, a couple tools. There's the people side, the identification of that leader, and that takes some time, and there's a lot of discussion around that, right? Who's the best person? You know, do you pull that person off something else important? And that's where you see the first prioritization. If they pull a mom or dad who's truly excellent, right, who you know can do this, that's when you know things are getting serious, right? That they have a leader who's got a day job, who they're asking to step into this. Then you're like, okay, this is a real investment for the FBI in change. Then now, and again, I can't speak to exactly how it's being run under Director Wray, but when I was there, some version of this, you know, you start to put in place, there's a working group, right? And you use the business processes that have been created, and some of them are still there from the balance scorecard. There's processes in place to drive these things. So there's processes in place to create strategic objectives. There's processes in place to write strategic initiatives. There's processes in place to create timelines and identify accountable executives, as I mentioned. And then there's mechanisms in place to create performance metrics. So here's where we want to go. Here's how we think we're going to get there. But let's stop in 6 months and look at the data and see if where we're investing is actually driving us there. We could be investing a lot of things to bring in a cyber workforce that in turn are not working, right? So making sure there are those metrics. One of the things Director Mueller did that's had a real lasting impact is staff that kind of work. And again, I was a recipient of some of those jobs. Prior to the creation of the Associate Deputy Director job and what's now called the Resource Planning Office, if you wanted to do those things, the mom or dad would have to find that team, that staff out of Hyde, whether it's in the criminal division or the counterterrorism division. Now, through the Resource Planning Office and the investing in bringing in folks who are professional initiative managers, project managers who have expertise in performance metrics, all the things that are in my background as well. It's beneficiary of this. That then can sustain and support these efforts over time. So in terms of a case study and what it might look like, it's going to look like, I mean, it sounds kind of cliche, but you got to start with that working group, right? And bringing folks together from different organizational pockets in the FBI who all have equity in an issue. You bring those folks together, you staff that working group with the resource planning office staff, and you actually buy into a process where you say, okay, over the course of, say, 4 weeks or 6 weeks or 12 weeks, depending on what you're dealing with, we're going to walk you through a process of writing strategic objectives, right? Like, where do we really want to go? Making sure we have those things in mind. Writing out those initiatives that we think or believe are going to take us there. Developing those performance metrics that we're going to check in on and see if we're getting there. That's sort of phase one, is that planning phase. And then there will be an offshoot of that working group that's the implementation team. Because, again, these complex issues, whether we talk about, you know, the professionalization of the intelligence workforce, cyber workforce, and the future of cyber, any of these things, they're difficult because they're not run by one organizational function at the FBI. And it is that collective action, that coordination driven by a strong mom or dad, supported by those strategy and performance management systems that really create success and get us over the hump. And the kind of success you've seen over time with the FBI being able to make change, which is challenging.
So how would you describe when this initiative started in cyber? How would you describe where the FBI was, and how would you describe where it was when you left in 2016?
That's a great question. I think from where I sat in the strategy management office, where this started, and then I ended up working for Sean Henry when he was executive assistant director over the criminal cyber response and services branch. So I both worked on it from the strategy management office side, and then I worked for it working for the dad in this case, who was kind of leading this, you know, a first kind of corporate run at and making improvements here. I guess my general sense was before it was more bottom up, right? So there was a small cyber division that was had pockets of extreme excellence led by people like Sean Henry and Steve Jabinski, who really had a vision for things before everybody was talking about it. And there's incredible leadership there, vision there. And they were doing things kind of bottom up to shore up operations, to build capacity, to hire people, all of those things. I would say by the time I left, there's no doubt that cyber is run from the center, right? There's real vision across the organization because cyber is a big thing, right? What does it mean? It's not just about intrusions and attribution, but it means a lot of things. It's run from the center. It's coordinated with partner organizations. It's got real long-term strategic vision that's, you know, integrating with academics and integrating with other, you know, whether it's intel community partners or law enforcement partners. And there's a real kind of thought leadership from the center and top down and bottom up in some ways, especially in cyber. You need that bottom up. You need those folks out in the field offices who are innovating, right, and creating tools on the go and seeing what the threat is. But there's ability to bring that back to center now and share those best practices across. So capacity building obviously increased, but I think also from a management perspective went from being a priority project for one division to being a corporate priority, enterprise-wide priority. And that's a huge shift at the FBI.
And do you think of that as a Jim Comey thing or as a Mueller thing or as a Sean Henry thing or as a Sasha O'Connell thing?
Well, certainly not a Sasha O'Connell thing,
Like when we think of the progress that the FBI has made in the cyber domain, who is the mother or the father of that change?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I think you'd be hard-pressed to argue that, you know, there wasn't a kernel of beginning with Sean Henry and Steve Jabinski, right, who really raised the alarm and were saying this needs to be broader than, again, it was being worked, but it wasn't being worked corporately, kind of top down. Those guys were certainly the original dads. And I know I'm forgetting other people. I hate to always say names because you always forget people, the people around them, people like Jordan Kelly and others who worked with that team. So there was a core team from the beginning that, you know, developed expertise, had this vision, and kind of, as there always is at the FBI, right? It comes down to people in any organization. And then we watched it grow. And again, I may be limited in my knowledge sort of this time period, but when Sean became EAD, working with Director Mueller, certainly under Director Comey, bringing in other executives, this thing growing into a real enterprise-wide capability. And I think I know for sure Director Mueller saw it, Director Comey saw it, obviously Director Ray sees it as well, that it's not going away. It's a long-term threat. And it has a lot of, again, I think of back office, back counter functionality needs that need to be met, primarily around the workforce, right? And again, all the issues we talk about all the time around how do we compete for this talent when we can't pay the way Silicon Valley can pay and all of these things? How do we partner with academia? How does the FBI do that effectively to make sure we're being, right? Working in a threat environment where things are changing so quickly, there's organizational challenges around that that are going to be ongoing. I mean, for everybody, right? For all organizations in this space.
All right, let's talk about diversity, which is sort of a radically different strategic priority,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But it was something when I first set foot in the FBI building, which was probably in the mid-1990s, one of the things that was so striking about it compared to every other building that I walked into in Washington was that you heard Boston Irish and New Jersey Italian accents.
And you weren't going to say all white shirts and blue suits? That wasn't
no, so it was pre-Mueller. But I was stunned by how much the average person that you heard sounded like a – you know, sounded like they had sort of walked out of Central Casting FBI. And they had, you know, they had names – that were consistent with the accent. I mean, and it really did have the feel of a very elite, the sort of creme de la creme of a whole lot of Northeast big city police departments, right? And it seems really different now. And so I'm, you know, I know this was a sort of particular project of Director Comey's, but I'm interested to what extent this is another area where the ship just had to be turned. Yeah. What did that project look like?
So, you know, it's interesting to reflect on now, having been out 2.5 years, right? Both my personal experience in this regard and kind of organizationally the change that's happened. I will say from my – I'm going to talk a little bit about me and my experience as a woman at the Bureau, but organizationally, just to take that point – I will say it was much more – there has always been – again, I mentioned the directors are more the same than they are different. My experience under Director Fried, Director Mueller, and Director Comey, they were all focused on diversity of thought, right, being the lead thing, and thus wanted the best people for jobs and were always kind of looking to ensure that there was diversity of thought. Now, as I mentioned, it's one thing to have a mom or dad who believes in that kind of change. It's another thing to put processes in place, right, that actually focus on that. In my experience, that was definitely on the list with Director Mueller, right? As we went through planning, it was on the list. It reached new heights with Director Comey. I don't think anyone could doubt that, right? That it wasn't just on the list and in the processes, but it was something he was talking about in a very new way externally. When it comes to diversity at the FBI, or I think anywhere, there's supply and demand, right? There's the two questions. Are the agencies demanding it and actually making the organizational changes required to reduce, you know, barriers to entry and barriers to stay? And then there's the supply side, right? Are people interested in coming? And how do you do that? I would say, again, just Sasha's kind of perspective on this, looking back, I think all three directors I worked for, and I know Director Ray now, are focused on ensuring there's no institutional barriers to entry, that we're encouraging all those sort of demand things are being worked on. I think because Director Comey took such a public and outward-facing perspective on this and shared it, it helped on the supply side too. Right. People got the message outside of Washington, right, that the Bureau wants people who don't look right out of Central Casting. And so I think, is it a Comey thing? I think, again, certainly in the three directors I worked for, they all wanted to move this direction. And I did experience each of them doing those institutional things. But my hypothesis would be being so public really helped. I do a lot of talking to young women and, you know, focused on just that issue. It's hard to break through and make it seem real and understand their other jobs. You know, you don't have to go through doors. You don't have to carry a gun. And I think Director Comey being so, so public about his passion for diversity, you know, we don't have the data, but my guess is that was helped a lot, made a huge bump.
So I want to ask you about the going through doors. The combination of you don't have to go through doors and being female is a really interesting combination, mm-hmm. bureau-wise, right? Because there is – a two-tiered – every organization has the people that the organization is about and the people who the organization – who make up the rest of the organization, right? And at the FBI, as long as I have interacted with the FBI, there is a kind of class difference between what are called in the building gun carrying agents, right? Which everybody else calls agents. But, you know, in the building, people mention gun carrying and everybody else. And I'm interested in, you had a truly spectacular career in the FBI as a non-gun carrying woman. Mm-hmm. And I'm just interested in that, like, those two things in combination, mm-hmm. how'd it work?
That's such a great question. You know, again, being out, you don't think about it a lot when you're there, right? But being out for 2.5 years, you have some time to reflect. I think one of the things that really stands out in my mind was when I was selected by Director Comey to run the Office of National Policy. So it was an SES job, right? A big deal. And they do an announcement on the FBI intranet, which is actually something that works really well on the IT side. There's a very robust intranet where you can learn about everything going on at the FBI. And I started getting emails from women in the field offices saying, congratulations, woman, non-agent, SES, this is awesome. When women I didn't know. And a number of people at the Bureau said, like, that's so nice when I said that these are coming in. I said, no, it's not nice. It's pathetic, right? Like, why should it be a big deal that a woman non-agent became SES? It actually, I really appreciated they reached out, but it also kind of depressed me, right? And put in perspective that this is still a huge deal at this time that a woman non-agent, there just aren't a lot of them in the executive ranks. So it was an interesting perspective. I will say, growing up there, I didn't think about it much, right? I really didn't. And I would say to people about me and the FBI, is it, you know, did I come predisposed for this? You know, I had a brother and all male cousins, and that's how I grew up, and my personality is a great match. Or did I grow up at the FBI, and so that's what I thought was normal, right? Like, is it nature, nurture, whatever? I'm not quite sure. I did leave the Bureau for a time from 2002 to 2007, then came back, then left again. I will say, after leaving a second time and getting involved in organizations like NatSec Girl Squad and talking to a lot of young women interested in law enforcement, it has made me reflect more on what my experience was. I think there is striations of whatever you want to call it of job series, and it's not really two, right? It's multiple. There's agent, there's intel analyst, right? Then there's MAPAs, kind of others, and then there's others too. We have doctors and nurses and victim specialists and incredible technical people who do incredible jobs. But there can be, right, this kind of us and them mentality, and then this question of being a woman. So I would say a couple of reflections having been out. One, in retrospect, I think because I had incredible mentors, both men and women, who helped me navigate, who I had a boss once who someone said, you know, I was a unit chief at the time and I had an agent working for me. And it's like someone said, you know, I would never, right, work for a non-agent. Like, this is crazy, right? And they said that about me. And I talked to my boss at the time and he was like, even I'm not that old school. Do you know what I mean? Like, I had an amazing boss. Like, that's crazy, right? So I really lucked out. Both men and women, bosses, I think always, well, with one exception, agents, who, again, wanted the best in class, right? Wanted the best people in the jobs and were open-minded. So in a lot of ways, that didn't become a barrier to me. I do think, you know, I also developed a professional style that is really, I think I have a pretty thick skin, right? And I'm pretty focused on the positive. If you want to hear the negative in the comments and you want to get kind of wrapped around the axle, as we'd say about things, you can do that. Or you can keep moving forward, deliver, right? And move forward and get those opportunities and deliver and have a lot of success. Not to say, you know, I think, you know, supporting folks who come in, whether it's non-agent or woman, creating better networks so folks can support each other, share kind of resources and all those things. I think there's a lot of room for improvement there, you know, and there's certainly room for growth. But for me personally, I mean, the job was challenging in many, many, many ways. And I think I kind of co-evolved in terms of how I process and deal with challenge. But overarchingly for me, it was not a huge issue. And I do feel like I had or created all the opportunities I could have ever wanted there.
So this week, there is a lot of discussion about what a lot of people are sort of asserting should be a new area of strategic priority for the FBI, which is, depending on how the speaker formulates it, right, you know, white supremacist terrorism, domestic terrorism, as the Phoenix field office put it in some intelligence analysis, conspiracy theory-driven crime or events. I think it's reasonable to expect that there will be significant political pressure on the Bureau over the coming months to kind of adopt this as a not instead of foreign terrorism or cybersecurity by any means, but as additionally a major kind of new area of strategic priority. So I'm interested for your thoughts on that. To what extent is this already something the Bureau is doing and simply people don't notice? I do, whenever one of these shootings happens, the Bureau is all over it. So it's not, you know, it's not like it's not something that people are focused on there. To the extent that the Bureau has to develop new capacity and new focus in this area, what would be your advice to thinking about it as a strategic matter?
Sure. It's a great question. You know, I've been out of the counterterrorism program for many years, but from where I sat all along, I think, I don't have the data in front of me, folks will find the FBI has never taken their eye off this ball, right? Hate crimes, domestic terrorism is very much in the core functional operational priorities of the FBI, right? Full stop. So I think folks will find that and find a commitment to that mission. You can see the FBI Agents Association has been pressing for many years for a federal statute around this issue. So I just want to clarify there that this is not new.
Yeah, so let's talk about that, because I actually think I agree with that. I think, you know, the principal organization in the United States that investigates hate crimes is the FBI, at least if there's a federal nexus to it.
Yep.
And the question of terrorism, domestic terrorism, is largely, though not exclusively, a nomenclature mm-hmm. question, because mm-hmm. there aren't a lot
exactly.
of
There's
major
nonsense.
Offenses that
exactly.
the FBI looks at and says, well, we have no jurisdiction to get involved in
right,
that,
right.
At least not in, you know, I guess if they're done exclusively with guns in a very local setting, you
yeah.
can have some jurisdictional barriers. But mostly – and so how much of people's sense that the Bureau is not – like is not oriented in this direction is simply a factor that we have a whole series of foreign terrorism statutes, including the material support statute, which is such a bread and butter workhorse. Whereas on the domestic side, it's not that the activity is legal. It's that it's called things other than terrorism. And so when the Bureau gets involved, it doesn't create a check mark in the terrorism box. How much of this is just a perceptional thing about, you know, that's really more about the nomenclature than about Bureau focus?
It's a great question. I think one that's difficult to answer quantitatively, right? We don't know. I think, you know, it's so difficult from the outside. The Bureau doesn't talk about, and when they do, it doesn't often get attention, right? There's a lot of preventions in this area that happen every day that either don't get talked about, or when they do get talked about, don't get picked up nationally, right? It's a broader question about the FBI, about how to explain where they're investing their resources proactively. You know, back in 99, 2000, when we were talking about the CTD strategy, you know, you can, as a goalie, you can stop 10,000 balls, right? But one that gets through, and again, there's no indication on either of the things that happened last weekend that they were on the radar of law enforcement and this got through, but just got through in a broader sense of like our inability to prevent, right, is going to create this public outrage and public desire and to do something, which I agree with, right? I feel the same way. So to your specific question, I think it's quantitatively difficult to say why folks aren't as aware of the work that the Bureau does on hate crimes and domestic terrorism. I think that's tough to say. To your earlier question about what would I recommend, I think I, like everybody, feel passionately, right? We have to do something to stop the epidemic of mass shootings, right? There's no doubt. I think when you're in law enforcement, what happens, though, there's cyber, there's counterterrorism, right? There's counterintel, there's domestic terrorism, and there's this question of balance, right? You have limited resources. And if you look at the size of the FBI's budget, right, relative to some budgets of things that we do in the world, it is incredibly small, right? So I guess if I was there, a couple of thoughts or recommendations. One is to, again, do the job they always do, which is explaining what's already underway, so we don't swing the pendulum or sort of make some dramatic mistakes, to make sure that to the extent they can, that they're sharing with the public the incredible work that the Bureau is doing every day around hate crimes and domestic terrorism, both prevention and response. Then the second question is, because this happens today, but then, God forbid, whatever might happen next on the cyber side or counterterrorism side, that to the extent possible, there's transparent discussions about trade-offs, right? So if there's going to be new resources, that would be the best. If the FBI could get new agent and intel analysts to work hate crimes and domestic terrorism, I think that's the number one solution, and that's great. And you can use some of the processes and leadership pieces I talked about to make sure they're integrated and they're working effectively. More likely, they'll be asked to be trade-offs, right? And so that is where things get very challenging. And if those trade-offs are not transparent, then a year from now or 2 years from now, right, and people ask, well, what's going on with that program or this program? And the Bureau says, well, those folks were diverted to work hate crimes and domestic terrorism, all good things, right? But this is the tough work of leading these organizations, right? It's limited resources, complex threat environment, balancing, we talked about at the local level, but also at the national level, the desire of stakeholders and the population, right, to weigh in on what the priorities should be, balance that with what we know around data about where the threat is, right, and try and create those trade-offs. To me, the one thing I think is incredibly important that organizations, the FBI being one of them, is transparent as possible about those trade-offs so folks understand, if you're robbing Peter to pay Paul, where that's coming from. Because, again, if the size of the pie doesn't change, Ben, like, you know, it's got to come out of another priority program. The Bureau doesn't work things that don't matter, right? So, again, unless Congress wants to come through with new resources, which is amazing and would be fabulous, there's got to be a trade-off there. And that's where those difficult conversations come in. And again, to the extent you can include and be public about that, I think the better for everybody.
Sasha O'Connell, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure to be, what's it called? The Jungle Studio? Amazing.
Come back sometime.
Thank you. It'd be an honor.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Hey, all you people out there, in a few short weeks, the Report podcast has just about as many reviews and ratings as the Lawfare podcast. And this should be embarrassing all of you who have not yet rated, reviewed, and shared the Lawfare podcast on social media. We love the Report. We don't want to be embarrassed by the performance of the Report. So get out there, do your part, share it on Facebook, tweet it, put it on Pinterest. We were underperforming on Pinterest, people. Our audio engineer this week was Michaela Fogel. The Lawfare podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patya Howell. Our music, as always, is performed by the one, the only Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.